You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, March 3rd, 2016. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Paul Mason on the end of capitalism. Also on the program today, more calls for Michigan Governor Snyder to resign in light of the latest revelations that Flint was essentially blackmailed into keeping that poisoned water for its citizens. Meanwhile, Mitt Romney launches his shadow campaign, ladies and gentlemen. The white knight has arrived.
Here I am, not a moment to, live.
I'm riding a Labrador Retriever.
I've arrived. Hey, everybody, how about tax returns? And phoniness. Issues I'm extremely well credible on. Also, racism.
I want to say I have been meaning for the past 4 years to say I reject Donald Trump's endorsement for the 2012 presidential race.
I didn't even know I was there. I was so distracted by all of the disgusting janitors and various other poor people in Vegas that I didn't even know where I was.
To be honest, I had an earpiece in my ear, and I had no idea what Donald Trump was saying.
And by the way, when I say poor people at 47%, I don't mean all Negroes and Hispanics. I just mean the disgusting poor of all backgrounds.
Meanwhile, folks, as Mitt Romney comes out and boldly endorses himself to be president or to win the Republican primary, Marco Rubio looks like he's having his last stand. And in Texas, a state election may end up making your kids stupider. Abortion rates drop despite conservative efforts. And researchers find strong evidence that the Republican Party wins with racism.
Wow.
And congratulations, February, you shattered global warming records. So you had that going for you.
We did a fantastic job as a month.
Ladies and gentlemen, I should tell you right now, we pre-taped this interview with Paul Mason a couple of weeks ago. He's just, my understanding is he just left his broadcast position. I don't know if he had done that when we had spoken to him because of his support in the UK for Jeremy Corbyn. So we didn't get to that. I mentioned that only because we had some listeners who were asking for us to ask him about that, and can't do it, obviously, because didn't know about it and have already recorded. I could ask him, but he wouldn't be able to answer because we're not live. We will talk about this. We just finished watching this Mitt Romney speech that he gave, I guess, asking Republican voters to not vote. I'm not exactly sure, frankly, what it is that he was asking them to do. Vote for anybody but Trump, but a different person in each state.
I think it was implicit.
Well,
I think you could figure it out with that Jew noggin of yours.
We're going to get into it later. But this was fascinating because he really was basically saying, vote for me. And to really tease it out, he was saying, vote for me. I'm not on the ballot, but the best way to vote for me would be to vote for a different person, depending on which state you're in, to prevent Donald Trump from getting a majority of delegates, reaching whatever it is, 1273, I think it is. And thereby, even if he has a plurality of those votes, we can change the rules at the convention, which would allow me to come in and become your nominee. So please, I beseech you, we will talk more about it as as the show progresses. I will say we are now in March. This has got to be a long-term play for him, right? March, April, May, June, July. So he's got 4 months. I think he'll probably crop up every, 3 to 6 weeks.
He still
maybe
has
he's doing this for Paul Ryan. I have no idea.
Yeah, it could be him or Ryan. He still has that odd glint in his face every time he thinks that he's scored a point in his speech, where he sort of pauses and looks at the camera like, I just stuck the knife in.
And
let's pause and let it sink in.
Not clear if you're aware, that was a joke when I said about the free hats.
Sick bird.
Okay.
Anyone?
Yeah, sorry. I had to throw in a little bit of humor, even though we are facing the complete disintegration of our country. Just wanted to make that hat joke. So, just to show that I'm not a robot. So, what kind of robot would put in a joke about a man's hat when he's talking about saving the United States of America's democracy? So, there you go. Not a robot. I repeat. Folks, it's March. And everybody knows that good things come in three. March is the third month of the year. Also happens to be Harry's.com's 3-year anniversary as a business. If you're new to Harry's, I've got a special deal for you. Try 3 of their expertly crafted 5-blade German razors. A reminder, 5 is 2 plus 3. Just trying to tie in the 3 thing. And shave cream for $10, which is $7 more than 3. So there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. No, you all know what kind of... I'm a huge fan of Harry's. Look, they advertised on this program, I don't know, it was a while ago. I got a Harry's razor, and I have to say, it's really the first... I don't think I've ever had any type of loyalty to a razor brand before. And I'm quite old. So that's impressive to me. I don't know. I guess I'm impressed by it. The blades are super sharp. It's a great shave. The razor itself, I'm going to concede something right now. I mentioned before that a long time ago, my dad had got me one of those horse feather, brushes. I don't even know if they make them anymore. This thing is so old. And I never used it. But now with the Harry's razor cream, I use it because I realize, like, I know why people use this. Because you get the water dripping down your arms. And so now I use it, and it actually works. It looks good in the medicine cabinet. I know that's not relevant to any of this, but I like it. And the razors are super sharp. I get a great shave. And I'm not going to say that I'm a cheap person, but I am a little bit frugal. So I get a great shave, and it's incredibly inexpensive relative to you pay $32 for a pack of, what do you get? They get 8 blades in that? You can get them for half the price at harrys.com. The starter set is $15. You get a razor, moisturizing shave cream, 3 razor blades. And if you've never gotten Harry's before, Harry's will give you $5 off your first order with the promo code MAJORITYREPORT. Stop overpaying for a great shave. Go to harrys.com right now. That's H-R-A-R-R-Y-S MajorityReport.com. Enter the code MajorityReport at checkout. We're going to take a break and listen to, and then we will be back with our interview of Paul Mason. And then following that, of course, we will talk about Mitt Romney and these other stories. I want to remind you folks, tonight we will be doing coverage of the 11th Republican debate. We're down.
Oh, boy.
Down to four.
Oh, man.
And
I cannot believe how many of these things can happen.
Well, I don't know. It sounds like actually there could be a lot more. I mean, right. I wonder if they'll let Mitt Romney onto the debate.
I'm not running, but I will debate.
I'm sure Fox will allow me to sit and I'm going to ask the questions. How's that?
I'm going to mystery science theater it myself.
So we will be doing that tonight. Tune in about around 8:40.
Also, I promise that even though sadly he will not be on the stage, if you're with us, you will hear Ben Carson's perspective.
There you go. That's right. Tonight's debate. We will provide the shadow Ben Carson. Also, should tell you that Michael is going to be co-hosting a new podcast that we're going to release. I think we're going to release this on Tuesday. Is that right? Of next week?
That's the plan.
Michael's going to be co-hosting with his buddy, Phil, a podcast called Two Dope Boys. I don't know what that's a reference to. I have no idea.
Two Dope Boys and a podcast.
Oh, okay.
Is the full name of the show.
Well, no, I was not informed of that. So now I know. And you're going to talk about trends and...
Trends, brands, culture. It's kind of, I think it will deal with some of the things that we talk about on this show. There is some politics to it, a lot of racial conversations, but it's really geared primarily actually towards people who are like creative professionals who want to sort of anticipate what's happening in culture and why. So we've already recorded several. So as an example, we talked about how perceptions are changed in the Middle East and China through exposure to hip hop culture, as an example like that. That's actually a positive part of American cultural diplomacy.
That sounds very regressive to me, Michael.
It's like corporate regressivism.
All right.
We also have a brand apology of the week, which is how we start off each episode, which is
really,
really
fun. Don't tell everybody. We'll unwrap it slowly. It's like an onion. What? Tell people. We should tell people that? Well, I was going to say we're going to talk about it tomorrow.
Well,
too.
Yeah,
so
well,
you need to
well,
leave
well,
something
well,
on the
yeah.
table.
Well, that's the first. Well, there's a lot more on the table. But anyway, right. I'm really excited about it. Phil and I became friends about a year and a half ago. We have a really similar perspective on things, but very different life experience. And I'm excited about it.
Well, all right. There you have it, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to be releasing this on Tuesday. We will talk more about this as we go on. All right, folks, take a quick break. When we come back, Paul Mason. We are back on the Majority Report. Sam Cedar on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program the author of Post-Capitalism, A Guide to Our Future, Paul Mason. Paul, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
So let's start with this idea of technology. I mean, this is and where you are, where you get the notion that technology is ultimately, it's brought us to a point where we are perhaps on the verge of a post-capitalist era.
Well, we're not on the verge. We're on the start of a transition path, I argue, to a post-capitalist era, because the technology is developing in a way that is not compatible with the market relationships that we used to regulate and guide our economic life right now. So, many of your listeners will be very familiar with the human action, thumb on the command key, finger on the C key, thumb on the command key, finger on the V key, copy and paste. Yeah?
I cannot copy tell you paste. How much of my day, honestly, is spent doing that one repetitive action.
Yeah, and so if you do it to an email somebody sent you, that's fine. If you do it to an academic paper that you've downloaded from the internet, that's fine as long as you do one paragraph. You do the whole thing and put it on your website, you're breaking the law, okay? But as a product, things that can be copied and pasted are what we call in economics, they are non-rival. It means I can use it and not degrade it, and you can use it at the same time, and you don't degrade it either. It's different to lipstick. It's different to a parking lot. It's different to a cigarette. It is non-degradable and infinitely copyable. And what economists, since the 1990s, understood about information goods, because this is what we're talking about, any information good is able to be copied and pasted forever. Economics says, the basic laws of economics say, if that happens, the price of that thing is going to end up to be zero. No, that's a big thing, because this is the first time in the history of capitalism we have products whose natural price is zero. And from that, this is not just me, this is some very, very eminent mainstream economists conclude that information is different economically. And my book and the thesis I'm trying to argue here flows from the idea that information is a different kind of economic thing.
And in the event that, I mean, it's a different kind of thing, I mean, because it is a product that could be, I guess, theoretically enjoyed by a piece of it. This podcast could theoretically be enjoyed by every person on the planet.
Yeah.
And really, the value of it, I guess, does not diminish after the first person, whether it's one person who listens to it or
well, the human billions. Value doesn't diminish. It's just that the commercial value diminishes very rapidly to naught.
Yes.
So here's a real thing. Every iTunes track that exists could theoretically be listened to by everybody on Earth. Most people on Earth aren't going to listen to all music that's ever been written and recorded, but theoretically they could be. iTunes is a product that is designed around a set of hard technologies like bits of metal and hard drives and, you know, iPods, you remember them, and then Macs and all the rest of it. Now, the thing about it is, somebody did this calculation, to make the minimum wage, a signed recording artist, solo artist, would need probably to sell 1,000, maybe 1,500 tracks on iTunes. That's not a lot of money for 1,500 tracks.
Right.
But once we go to sharing, and I'm talking about commercial capitalist sharing, not pirating, not what teenagers do in their bedroom all the time. Once we go to sharing, something like Spotify, the number of plays on Spotify that produce the minimum wage for a signed recording artist is 1.1 million.
Wow.
So what does that tell us? It tells us as soon as the competition kicks in, as soon as the market kicks in, what happens to information goods is they collapse in price. And this is very bad for people who produce information. Me, you, scientists, recording artists. But it's very good for the final consumer. And we've been living with this problem for maybe 15, 20 years. Those of us who have been on the early internet knew you could copy and paste things quite freely. The real mind-bending fact comes when you consider how much of physical reality is now an information product. The atomic structure of the fan blade on the next jet airliner you get on, the atomic structure of the fans you see as you board the airline, is an information product. It couldn't exist without a computer. So what do we do about that? Now, my thesis in the book is that, look, we're not surrounded by things that are collapsing in price to zero. We're surrounded with by piracy and attempts to stop it. But by and large, the corporate world has found ways to keep prices of information goods positive. That is, you have to buy the next Beyoncé album on iTunes for money. You have to buy a copy of some software or an app for your phone for money, even though it could easily be copied for free. But what it's doing to the market is it's turning it very, very sludgy, very monopolized, so that you're only getting two or three, or maybe sometimes even one company in each sector guarding this huge treasure pile of information. And my argument is that's not great for capitalism, and it's not really a survivable kind of capitalism to have all information locked up behind corporate monopolies.
Okay, so there's a couple of different aspects that I want to examine here. I mean, one is that first premise that, and I think everybody can agree that, you know, that information, that digital information in particular, I guess.
Yeah, we're talking about digital information.
Is a fundamentally different commodity than we've seen really ever, I guess. And then the next question is whether that drives the price of that information ultimately to zero. And then the other aspect of this is that notion that even those things that we run into in the physical world are now essentially information products that just sort of manifest themselves for what is ultimately, I mean, you know, and I guess when we contemplate that, it's like low-cost 3D printers or something like that, I guess, would be the sort of the manifestation of that. But let's take number two of that list, because from my experience, right, I can tell you that technology, I would not be able to have this job, this specific one, 20 years ago, maybe, for all practical purposes, maybe 25, let's just shut the door at 30 years ago, I would not be able to do this job. I am making money from it. The people theoretically, certainly it would not be hard for people to get my entire product for free. My entire business model could sort of fall apart. I mean, I have some advertising, but so what is fundamentally different about that exchange?
Okay, look, there are many of us, me included, who live now in an information world. My products that I produce are information. I go to Gaza, I see bombs explode, somebody films it, it becomes a little video on Facebook, somebody buys advertising against it. That's the world we live in. Now, the thing is, you can still sell information. And of course, there is intellectual property that's very important. Intellectual property is very important and, you know, very sacrosanct for those of us who live by it. But here's the problem with it. Intellectual property is like it means you have to reimpose capitalism every day with almost like from the computer screen of a lawyer. It's like normal capitalism, when you had goods that you couldn't reproduce for free, that you couldn't copy and clone and consume for free. Normal capitalism just kind of reproduced itself. You know, I don't know where your studios are, but, you know, where are your studios, Sam?
In Brooklyn, New York.
In Brooklyn. So in Brooklyn, the guys on Vinegar Hill, the guys in Dumbo, the guys who were 50 years ago hauling, you know, sacks of potatoes out of ships, yeah? Nobody had any problem about that kind of capitalism. It reproduces itself every day.
Right.
When you have to say to your workers, hey, if you have an idea in the shower after coming home from work, that's our idea. And that belongs to us, the little software startup you work for, and not to you. That's not capitalism. That's weird. That is a response to something new, and that is the unique power of information to transmit itself for free across human brains using digital technology. Okay, now, why hasn't the world collapsed? I argue because the way capitalism responded to the rise of information was to create information monopolies. And many people, tens of thousands of people work for information monopolies. And new ones are being set up all the time. And what they exist to do is harvest the free stuff that human beings create when they interact digitally and commoditize it and commercialize it and sell it. My only worry about that is it's just not sustainable. It's not the same as running AT&T or Siemens or Toyota. It's just not the same because you have to impose legal relationships on everybody all the time, forever.
Yeah, but they do that, right? I mean, every time we click on, we go on Facebook and basically provide the commodity that Facebook will sell, we have, and you know, I've done shows on the implications of this in terms of our legal system and whatnot, but we have agreed. We have sold away our rights. And you know, some type of binding clause. If we have a problem with it, maybe arbitration, but there's really no recourse for it.
No. Yes, no, that's how it works. And, you know, it's even clearer if you use iTunes or Apple of any description. Every 2 or 3 days, you try and do something and a new contract comes down the line.
Right.
Will you agree to the new terms that we impose? I mean, the people, the lawyers are getting rich anyway, but fair enough. Okay, that's them. They produced intellectual property. I don't begrudge them that. Here's the problem. Capitalism survives crises by evolving, and it survives them by being adaptable and mutating. What usually happens, economic historians believe this has happened 4 times in the history of 200 years of capitalism. You get a slump, and out of the slump comes a new technology, and it brings higher wages, higher living standards, higher general levels of cultural life, because what is created in the new upsurge of capitalism is a valuable thing that you can charge a lot of money for. So cinema, you know, cinema was an amazing, 1911, 1912, 1913, suddenly everybody wants to go to the cinema. Workers will save their entire wage, go to the cinema. It's only silent. There's no sound. The cinemas in England where I live are like little tunnels of, they're like garages, you know, in size. But everybody wants to go because it's expensive and therefore you need higher wages. And so people get higher wages. My huge concern about the future of capitalism is that the information dynamic creates lower wages, just as the same as it creates low prices. And the stuff that we invent does not have this quality that cinema had, that vinyl records had, that buying a computer. You remember that in the 1980s? You bought a computer. The first computer I bought was a Spectrum ZX, and I spent really nearly about half my monthly wage on it to get it. That's not the same for an app. It's either cheap or free. And the capitalism, as a result, is not adapting and not creating new high-wage jobs. Instead, what it's doing, and this is where my book links, kind of joins the dots. It says, if you're surrounded by people who are precariously working for very lowish wage jobs with no job security, and you're using a lot of information technology, there's a link between that, because modern capitalism is creating a low value economy. And that's the link between the zero price and the world we live in.
I mean, we see that on some level, I guess, with something like Uber on some level, right? I mean, is that?
Don't get me going on Uber.
Well,
I have to restrain myself.
Well, but go on Uber. I mean, how does that fit into this? I mean, so is the idea that we hit that there is a point, right, in your your theory where it breaks down, the machine breaks down in some sense.
Yeah, look, I think Uber and Airbnb exist to prevent the equivalent of Wikipedia arising in the taxi space and the apartment space. Because if they hadn't pre-colonized those spaces, we would have tools where we share apartments and share taxi rides or find taxi rides, that those tools would be tools in the hands of either ourselves or even the industry, the yellow cab drivers who are, you know, I know every New Yorker knows and loves. In other countries, that's what happens. You know, in Greece, the yellow cab drivers have an app. You can see the guy's face, so you know it's a real person. You get into it, you rate him. If he's no good, he doesn't get on the app again. That's information technology working for everybody. When information technology works only for the company with a multi-billion dollar valuation, which can only be justified by conquering the world forever and for all time, I begin to worry, because I think what's happening here is corporations moving into the space of what I was quite happy a year ago to call the shared economy. Now, people, when they say the word shared economy, they spit the next sentence. They worry that the shared economy, the sharing economy, is becoming a kind of rip-off economy. And people are worried about it, especially here in Europe. You may know that, you know, in Amsterdam, yes, in Holland, Uber's offices were raided by the police. You know, it's been declared illegal. There's huge battles going on throughout the rest of Europe.
Well, we're starting to see actually some of that, at least in terms of the way that Uber defines itself, right? I mean, yeah, it argues it's simply hiring private contractors. Well, if that's the case, then what could happen is, I mean, theoretically, right, this is all they're providing is this sort of brokerage technology. And there's no reason why the drivers themselves couldn't
there's no reason why a local government like New York City or like London
couldn't
set up its own app. This is the weird thing. Fair play to Uber. They set up their app and that's good for them, and the problem is that the valuation of the company is kind of predicated on it dominating the world. Okay, I don't think it's going to dominate the world. And when you ask people who study the evolution, the very rapid evolution of these one-time monopolistic kind of herogram companies, they always basically say to you one word, BlackBerry. BlackBerry. You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
BlackBerry. Who has a BlackBerry now? And we may in 10 years' time ask, I think in 10 years' time we'll see Uber and Airbnb as the Alta Vista of the sharing economy. The sharing economy is going to be much more like Wikipedia than it is going to be like Uber. But let's have a thousand models, but let's not have one that dominates everything.
Well, how do you know that just as we predict that Uber will be the Alta Vista in 10 years, that there won't be a another Uber to Alta Vista? In other words,
I don't. And one thing that I am absolutely pro is innovation and entrepreneurship. My model of moving beyond capitalism is based in many ways on an innovation and entrepreneurial spirit in a way that really annoys the traditional kind of socialist leftist version of post-capitalism. I say that it's possible to make the transition to a non-market economy by accentuating the positive about the sharing, the cooperation, the non-managed space that network technology gives us. It's not the only thing we're going to have to do, because we're going to have to work out how to pay people. We may come to that. I'm also in favor of the rapid automation of the world. I don't think we should fear automation. The reason we fear it is because we don't have the social arrangements to enact it without making most people poor. So we should step back and say, automation, AI, robotics are coming. Let's think of ways that everybody could participate in that, rather than it's going to turn us into a kind of, it's going to be basically turn us into Elysium. You know that Matt Damon film, Elysium?
Right. Well, but where is the incentive, though, to make that transition, as opposed to the capitalist instinct even if it has to be, well, I mean, not just has to be, but artificially impose these barriers that maintain the value of this information in the context of your argument?
Well, where are the incentives? We have to create them. And remember, we are creating perverse incentives. You know, there are courts all over the globe right now are being asked to consider, is Uber legal? You know, Barcelona, the city in one of the big tourist spots in Spain, in Catalonia, Barcelona has more or less outlawed both Uber and Airbnb. And not only that, individual people who are putting their apartments on Airbnb are being told to register them as tourist apartments. Great, you can do that. You don't do it, you lose the apartment. Sorry. We have too many tourists in this city, and we have a lot of empty registered small hotels that are very nice, that where families for generations have built these businesses. We're not going to see them die. Now that's a social choice. Now, I know a lot of Americans love the idea of the free market, but to me, the free market is a free market on a level playing field. So the small business owner in Barcelona who's built their hotel and kept a clean sheet forever on the regulations you have to follow to have a hotel, you know what they are. They're very, very onerous in some European cities. They can't be competed with by some guy who decides to buy two apartments and let one on Airbnb. They can, as long as he plays by the same rules. So in a way, there's a kind of, let's protect ourselves against going too fast down the route of what technology allows us to do. But there's also a part of the story that says, let's accelerate what the technology allows us to do, but let's do it in a fair way. And society has to intervene through that little old thing that we invented. You know, you guys invented and created 250 years ago, the state, the federal government. The only way you're going to do it is by getting the government to say, here are the rules. And capitalism only survived 250 years ago, I argue, because the state set rules that it could prosper by. What we have to do now is the state has to step in and set new rules so that collaborative, sharing, free stuff can prosper alongside the best of, the most dynamic, the most socially positive parts of the market economy. So, you know, this is the point where a lot of your listeners probably go foaming at the mouth, because it's not socialism, but it is. It is post-capitalism. It is the idea that we could move beyond the market economy using state intervention to reset the rules of what kind of businesses are going to prosper through technology.
I'm not convinced that my audience isn't salivating at the notion, frankly. But
Some of them are. You know, but, what? And I think this is the thing. Look,
but let me ask
I'm
you
only...
this. But let me ask you this. I mean, because you draw the sort of the parallel that when feudalism ended, that the end of feudalism and is in some ways a model. I don't. Maybe I'm overselling that for this for the end of capitalism as we know it. But wasn't there also a concurrent sort of, I guess, broad intellectual understanding or reevaluation of just sort of the relationship of people to the state, I guess, or
well,
what could be
the market as well? Yeah, look, the parallels are limited, but feudalism was that system we know. You know, the knights in shining armor, the serfs with no rights, the church ruled all. You're lucky you didn't have it in America, but we had a lot of it in Europe, and we still live with the architectural and some way social remnants of it. Now, okay. At a certain point, around about the time of Henry VIII in Britain, it began to give way to merchant capitalism, where the market, commerce, sailing and trading, unfortunately also slave trading, began to predominate. Okay, now, what happened? It was slow. It was a values-driven transition. So I would argue Shakespeare is more important in the transition to capitalism than Sir Francis Drake, or Walter Raleigh, the English pirates who were stealing all the gold from the Spanish galleons coming from Mexico. I would argue that the ideas were more important. And it was a slow process, and it had ups and downs. And over 200 or 300 years, there was a long transition. But the end of it, there's no more knights in shining armor. The kings are gone or sidelined. The church is sidelined as a political power and economic power. And you get the free individual. Now, this is why I say this. The old left tradition, there's a lot of left-wing people listening to this, maybe from the old left, said, you can't learn anything from that process. We will do something really swift. We will do it really as if it's like an instant plan thought up by us, and the transition will maybe take 50 years. I say that we are, the technology is putting us on a transition path that's going to last hundreds of years. We have to understand that it's going to take a long time. It's going to be quite spontaneous, quite ideas-led. And we need to understand, we kind of situate ourselves within it and progress it and push forward. And everybody does their own thing. You set up your own cooperative cafe, or you publish some articles for free under a Creative Commons license, or you set up a time bank or a food bank, or you basically try and do things outside the market. It's not going to change the world immediately, but changing the world immediately turned out to be a really bad idea in the 20th century for those of us who want to replace capitalism with something better.
And so in the meantime, it is a push to, I guess, promote those values via policies. I mean, promote
not just
the,
that. Okay. Not just that. I think you can live it as well. To me, I say that the transition to post-capitalism is also a human transition. So everybody in every apartment party or every bar in Brooklyn, in New York, in New Jersey tonight, listening to this this show, who is living a life that they want to live, freer than their parents lived, and using technology to do that, is doing just the same as 500 years ago, people like Shakespeare and Molière and Sir Francis Bacon, one of the first scientists, or Galileo, did. They are taking part in an ideas revolution that I argue is going to be more important to the economic outcomes than just maybe doing some economic stuff like running a taxi firm. So yeah, you can do your bit for the transition to a different kind of economy by just doing what you want to do. You don't need a 5-year plan. You don't need an overarching state to do it.
What do you think that the capitalists, the ones who are interested in walling off that information, I mean, how do you think that they're going to respond? Or is it irrelevant, at least in terms of, I guess, the sands of time?
I think there's two camps. There are the people who don't even know this is an issue. Okay, they don't really even understand it. Fine for them, but they will soon. Then there are people who get it, and these are the big tech companies. Their entire business model is based on walling off information and valorizing it and giving it value as a marketable commodity. And I think there are, no, that's fine for them, but I think they'll go the way of BlackBerry. In the end, they'll have the market capitalization of BlackBerry Corp, whatever that is now. But there are some who understand the transition's coming. And since I wrote the book, a lot of people in the SME, the small business tech space, have said to me, look, we add value. Our little company adds value to, say, the tracking of containers of goods, containers that arrive on ships, yeah? Say our company adds value to that. Now, when we look back in our own, what do we use to do that in our supply chain? A lot of the stuff we're using is open source. A lot of the stuff we're using is, our tools and standards that are created for free by everybody and managed effectively, collaboratively by a community. Now, we still know where we make our money on the edge that nobody else can do, but we're very happy to defend the open source bit as free information. Even Google, of all the big tech companies, Google, it's getting a hammering here in Britain for not paying its taxes. Mm. But the one thing you can say about Google is that it built into its business model the support for what is even now technically an open source thing, which is the Android operating system. So the Android operating system legally is open source. Now, it's very, 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 very associated with Google and Samsung. So, how much could a bunch of hackers from Brooklyn, Fort Greene, take over Android? No, they couldn't. But the thing is, there are some companies who understand that they're getting for free stuff. And if just listen, some of your viewers might understand best if they think about this. If you had to account for every transaction your company makes with Wikipedia, it would be a lot of work, wouldn't it?
Right.
Because every day, every company in the world transacts with Wikipedia. It's just the fact that the stuff is free and it's produced by everybody else for free. I don't think we can go back. We can't commodify Wikipedia. It's there forever. You know, it's like trying to de-electrify a country. And in fact, what will happen is that more and more stuff will become like Wikipedia, Ruby on Rails. A lot of the stuff that Twitter uses, for example, to create Twitter is open source. That's my view is that's the source of their problems, trying to create a kind of defensible high-value company out of Twitter. A lot of the tech they use is effectively open source already, so there's nothing to put the wall around. Everybody already owns it. I think we're going to see, maybe in the 10, 15 years, a new kind of capitalist emerge who understands that they're going to have to build a company that can ride through the transition to a large amount of collaboratively produced open source stuff. Why do I know this? Because a lot of such companies, since I wrote the book, started to contact me. They started to say, how does our company survive the move? So, you know, I'm incredibly excited by it. I'm more excited by the idea that we can do a slow, controlled, humanitarian transition to a new society rather than a forced march, you know, kind of brutal one, because that didn't work.
Well, I hope you're right. The book is Post-Capitalism, A Guide to Our Future. Paul Mason, thank you so much for your time today.
Sam, it is always a pleasure to talk to you.
All right, folks, we're going to head into the fun half of the program. I will turn on my IM machine. As we have said in the past, this program relies on its members for 98.7% of our revenue. I know. Kelly just looked at me and said, you really should actually calculate something even remotely like that. But it's like that. It's close. I don't know. And so, folks, you can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Oh, that reminds me. Somebody sent me a link to this, and it came up in the context of the conversation with Paul Mason, and we've talked about it before. I think this is coming out of somewhere in Florida, but I'm not 100% sure. But you just might be interested in checking it out. It's drive-society.launchrock.com. We'll put a link at majority.fm. It is, I think, I haven't really dug into it too much, but it's the only rideshare business started by drivers, for drivers. So everything we've been talking about in terms of the way that like an Uber could be supplanted by a co-op. This is an attempt at that. So I don't know. You know, this is one of those things where you get notified whether or not it's coming to your city. And I put our email address in there because I just wanted to see the progress of something like this. And we've talked about it on multiple occasions. So we'll put a link. Somebody had tweeted to me on Twitter, and it just came up when I heard justcoffee.coop, and we were talking about it with Paul Mason. That's how my mind works, ladies and gentlemen. Also, what is not a co-op is Amazon. And if you buy your crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Majorityreportkickback.com. Also, you can check out Jet, which is an Amazon competitor. They ship all the stuff right to your house. They're not as monolithic. Is that the word I'm thinking of? Monopolistic? Well, they are a challenge to the sort of the Amazon's lock on that universe. So if you want to check them out, I think they're still offering 15% off for your first purchase. It's jet.com, but go to jet.com through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. You click on the link, you bookmark it, you do all your jet.com shopping through there. We get a kickback. That's the way we do this, ladies and gentlemen. Again, reminder, 8:40 p.m. tonight, the Republican debate, we anticipate being pretty drunk by 9:10. And
it's true.
It's true.
It's true.
It's going to be a really crazy show.
We're still going to do a tremendous job.
Of course. We're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. We will play. I mean, just because Mitt Romney today declared, I should say, implied his candidacy, or his openness to a nomination. We're going to play the sound from when Donald Trump endorsed Mitt Romney. And I should say, it's really not just like, that makes it sound like Donald Trump just got on. No, when Mitt Romney flew to Donald Trump's tower or hotel in Las Vegas and brought the king of the Republican Party, the proper, what is it, what they call when you bring like...
offering?
Yeah, but there's some other...
Tribute.
Tribute, yes, tribute. Exactly. Brought the proper tribute to the king of the Republican Party in his castle. It's like Game of Thrones. And then Trump went out and bestowed his blessing upon Mitt Romney. Didn't work, but still fun to watch in retrospect. All right, 646-257-3920 is the number. Hey, if you're a conservative, if you're a Trump supporter that we haven't talked to 5,000 times over the past 2 weeks, call in 646-257-3920. If you're one of those people who uses the term regressive left and can explain to us what it means, call in. If you're a libertarian, if there's any that exist out there anymore, I don't know, they seem to have disappeared.
The libertarians got schlonged.
They got schlonged.
Let's be honest.
Call in.
They're
you know
pathetic.
What? Let's open up a special line for any of those people. You can call in the right wing line. That'll be 646-257-3920. That'll be 646-257-3920. Take a quick break. Be right back after this.